So there's a beautiful quote from Rumi. Afka, it's been with me in my consciousness the last week or two. And it says, we are not a drop in the ocean. We are the ocean in a drop. And which can be the title of the talk. We are an ocean in a drop. And we do have a sense of it. The fact that I'm getting some smiles, a few, when you hear this quote, means that you know what. We all know. It may be mysterious, but we do know. When we look at the stars at night, we do know that there's something infinite out there, in here, out there, everywhere. And there's something endless and something unlimited. And I think everyone has intuition. The poets and the philosophers also talk about it. We don't need, you know, the Greek philosophers are talking about it. We don't need to go so far. We all feel, as living human beings, we feel there's a bigness of things somewhere. But our experience in daily life is very often just simply not there. And we feel contracted, mitkavetz. We feel that our life, we are separate and we are inside conditions and circumstances of life and controlled by conditions. This happens and oh, and this happens and oh, and this happens and ah. This you know, we're like a puppet on a string responding to circumstances. And we lose the sense, the real touch of something infinite. And it's not clear how to find it, aware this, to really, really sense and in our being, the basar shelanu, in our flesh, to know the unlimited. It's just really hard. So we have this duality of a sense of unlimited, of infinite, and a struggle called life, and especially these days. And the Buddha described this as we are swept along, because in nischafim, we are swept along like someone in a boat, and he or she catches the branch and says, stop, stop, stop. And the river is too strong. The boat keeps going and you catch, stop, stop. No, it keeps going. And we feel very much we're in that, and especially these days of conflict and war and suffering and struggle and global warming and so much difficulty in our world. Our response to that duality, that sort of intuition of the beyond and the struggle of daily life, our response to that, a healthy response, is search, chipus. We are trying to close the gap by search, chipus. And by longing, by our real heart's desire, our heart's longing for liberation. And this, we can look at this differently and see this is the hint of the infinite in our conditioned life. It's the kind of whisper of nirvana inside samsara. It's the Buddha nature expressing itself or the big picture inside a person with limits and boundaries, inside separation. So it's longing, it's search, it's practice, it's... So sometimes we really have to say, yeah, it's okay to escape. Escape from the mess is not a bad, such a bad thing if we put it down. Go to a festival in Europe, go to whatever, take psychedelics. We can also put it as our search. Is the Buddha inside that is saying, go for it, go for it. And it's more than the Buddha inside, it's the infinite inside that's saying, yalla. And it's exactly this gap that the Buddha, in his first teaching, he addressed this gap. The Buddha didn't come out of his awakening with speeches about awakening. Actually, he tried. And everybody thought he was crazy. So he went back and he said, wait a minute, I can't do it like that. And instead he addressed this gap. Why is it that there is this total, infinite, awakened universe, and we feel so kind of schlepping along, somehow limited? And where is that limitation? So the Buddhist teaching addresses limitation rather than trying to kind of just talk about the ultimate. There's not so much talk about Nibbana in thousands of texts, but there's a lot of talk about practice and how to go from the limited to the unlimited. But what the unlimited is, not so much. So the Four Noble Truths are about how we lost the infinite and how we come back home to it. And it's a classic teaching, of course, you all know it. But in a way, it's a teaching that is with us all the way, whether we're beginners or we've been practicing 40 years, it's still such a deep wisdom. It seems really, really simple, but it actually goes all the way. And the first truth is that our sense of struggle, limitation, suffering happens because of the being born in a body and the effort we make to survive. Hisardut. The pressure to survive, and that means it's every animal and every plant and every insect and every living being has a pressure to survive. And from there comes suffering. And that's basically the first noble truth. But what's interesting for us, especially in this retreat, is the second truth. Because the second truth says there's a reason for suffering. It's not an absolute necessity to suffer, to feel limitation, to feel contraction, to feel life is a struggle. It's not an absolutely necessary. We can come out of that if we understand the reason for it. And the reason that we suffer and the reason for the contraction and the reason that we feel limited and we lost the infinite is basically that we make constructions. So attachment, the second truth, is it's a very hopeful truth, because it says these limitations are not built forever in us. They are constructions that we make and that we can unmake. And that's a really positive, it's a positive way of looking at things. So do look at the Four Noble Truths as the classic fundamental teaching of the Dharma as being very positive, because they say there's nothing that is fixed, that we create our pain because of the constructions that we make, the way we look at things, the sense of being inside some prison, but we're building our own prison. The prison isn't really there in life. And if we build it, we can unbuild it. We can undo it. So having the sense that suffering is a kind of a dynamic, it's coming out of something that we do to get ourselves, that we get stuck in things, but we can get unstuck. It's not given in life. Well, many people think it is, especially, you know, maybe the Jewish world thinks after Galut, exile, that's it. No hope. It's not like that. And the third truth says, yes, you can undo the attachment. You can stop making those constructions and then living inside them. And let go of attachments. And that's Nibbana, the third truth. And it really is, Nibbana is defined as putting out the fires of, that we are giving fuel to the fire of attachment. We are all the time feeding the fires of attachment. We just stop feeding the fire. And then Nibbana liberation happens. Again, this is a very positive way of looking at things. We just stop feeding our pain. We stop feeding our limitation. We don't have to, you know, kind of be stuck somewhere in the longing for freedom. We just have to stop feeding our non-freedom. The Pali word for attachment is upadana. Upadana is feeding. We just simply lo mazin et ha limitation, et ha separation, et conditioning. So Nibbana is defined as going back into the universe, coming out of this sense of constructing a separate me and the world, and with all the difficulty in that. And the fourth truth is the way to do it. The fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path. So the whole of the four noble truths is about undoing the obstacles, ha-micholim, is about meeting them and undoing them, and then freedom happens by itself. The beyond is revealed, is opened by itself. So, of course, one of the major attachments is me, is the me, and the sense of separation. The sense that I got disconnected from the universe and stuck into a separate body mind, and all the time I'm looking to go back somewhere to the universe. Attachment is to the self is one of the four attachments. There is also attachment to the senses, what we want, what we like, what we don't like, what I need, what I don't need, hishtokukut, the neediness, the all the stuff, 24 hours, I want this, I don't want that. We had it yesterday with the air conditioning. It's all the time. Things should be better. Things should be another way. I want it like that, or don't want it like that. So that's one another. That's the first attachment. Then there's attachment to rituals, habits, ways of doing things, things that we think are holy, kadosh, that things ought to be like this. Big structures that we believe. A third is views, where what we believe, what we think is true, and we think of them as facts, and we don't think of our thoughts as simply views of looking, the way we look at things, which are not, is not the truth, but just the way we look at things. That's attachment, a third. And the fourth is this attachment to self. But as you can see, there's a lot of self in all the other attachments as well. The self is sort of standing behind all of them. So it's the big one, in a way. The self is a super powerful attachment because we support it 1,000 times a day. Since we were few months old, when we discovered the self, the me, we built the me, shall we say, rather than discovered it, better word, we build it, we make it. And then we support it 1,000 times a day. And that's why it's so strong, that when we even think about, I just can't imagine how I can look at life without the me. What on earth is that about? It's impossible to imagine looking at life without a me. Because we, basically it's become the operating system of the computer called our life. It's become the operating system, the Marechet Hapala. It's what makes sure that we need it to survive. We can't drive a car, we can't cross a road, we can't, you know, if we don't know where the kitchen is, how are we going to have supper? We're totally not there. So we need an operating system, and the self is really a construction that puts things together. It puts ourselves in, it coordinates all of the energies and the activities of life. And the self has many layers and levels, and I will go into this later in the retreat, but to make it simple, we have a narrative self, which is the self that is my story, my memories, my identity, Israeli, English, old, young, like this, like that, male, female, etc. It's all the story, the identity, the stories that define us. It's more identity, you could say, zihut. And then there is the non-narrative self, which is more like the ownership that we feel, my body. It's something a bit under that narrative self. It's non-narrative, but it's there at the same time. It's very basic. I own my body. A sense of where is me, where is not me. Here is not me. I remember one of my early experiences of struggling with my Orthodox Jewish parents. But one day I came to my father and said, is this finger Jewish or not? And if so, where? At a pretty young age, I was challenging all of that sense of identity. And so the non-narrative self is really about ownership, fundamental boundaries, agency, it's me doing, and so on. And then there's another level of self which is really even more subtle than that, which is really a point of view, that we have a sense that there is a subject looking at the world. And it's a very, very deep, subtle place, but still it's a deep sense of primal self. What is interesting, bringing up the Four Noble Truths, is that the self is like every other attachment. It seems like, well, it's like the same as my attachment to cigarettes. So if I work against the, you know, the addiction, hitmakruyot, to cigarettes, then the same, I can work with the attachment to me, it seems. But yes, actually, how do we work with attachment? We free ourselves, firstly, by seeing it, by seeing the attachment that we have, by recognizing what gives us suffering, by allowing it, by knowing it, not by fighting it, but by saying, okay, I see you, I see what I'm constructing, what I'm building, the seeing of it, recognizing, seeing it, allowing it, and seeing that it comes and it goes. It's not there all the time. It's an experience that arises. It's not us. It's not built totally in us. And that working with the self is the same. It's an experience that arises and passes. So, but it's very strong, so we don't notice it. It seems very difficult to see, well, how does it pass? But it is still a construction that arises and passes. We all go to sleep tonight. Where's the self? Gone. So we are used to practicing in this way in the Dharma with thoughts, with feelings, with experiences, with pains in the body, with thoughts about our relationships, with the whole stuff, and seeing the stuff that it comes and it goes. It's coming as visitors into the consciousness. And it goes again. Not so easy to see the self as a visitor, but it's possible. And the principle is the same. We can meet the self as a point of view, not as a fixed, solid, made of concrete, because they're beton. It's a point of view. It's a way of looking. That's why with this retreat, if we couldn't do it with the self, we wouldn't have this retreat. This retreat and the whole teaching of anatta, which is so central in the Buddhist world, is because the self is still a construction that we make and we can unmake. So it's really place that's helpful, if we see it like that, the self is not something that we get rid of. we try and get rid of. It's not something that we need to believe in, non-self. It's like a filter. That a filter that makes it difficult for us to see the infinite, what's beyond the self. It makes it difficult for us to see nirvana, the beyond, the liberation, because when we look at anything, we see it through an object called me in the world. We see the masach. So the way to work with it is, first of all, to see it, like with every attachment. And so this is what we're doing. We need to see the self as it arises, as it changes, as it passes. We need to be friends with it. We need to dance with it. We need to love it. We need it. It's a construction that we need, like our hand. We don't have to be busy with our hand all day, 24 hours, like this. But we need a hand, and we need a self. But still, we can see it as a malbush, as a, some sort of a clothing that we don't need to feel. It is totally us. It is simply another arising experience, but a very dominant one. And what we, all the qualities that we are developing here, calmness, energy, insight, clarity, hitpakhud, the clarity, and some effort, all of that is needed to be able to really see the self and see its dynamic nature. And this is, by the way, an answer to someone that asked me in a petek today. I don't quite understand. If there's no self, then why do we make effort? Where's the effort? Isn't the self making effort? Sure, it's the self making effort. We need some effort because we need qualities of clarity and insight to be able to see the self and work with it. Like la louche, because they're to work with it. And we do need effort for that. So what we don't need is a sense that there's no self, so there's nothing to do. There is an experience of self. And so we need all the tools to really work with the experience of self and gradually dissolve it. One of the interesting images of what we practice here is the image of a witness, Edut. Because it's interesting, Edut is already stepping out of identification, or Hizdahut. We are out of it. So there's less self in witnessing something, but there's still self. So in a way, because a witness is still a point of view, but it's just an example of somewhere that's really helpful to reduce the power of selfing. And if we think about a thought like, oh, I don't know, I feel hot and I don't like, the weather is too hot and it was, I'm struggling and the me is totally in there. We step out and be the witness of that, and we see thoughts about being hot. Okay, I see you. Shalom lehitraot. Machshavot al chamli. Okay, I see you. The witness has some, Nisargadatta Maharaj has a very nice image. The witness has two faces. One is the face to the conditioned world, one is the face to the infinite world. So the witness has two faces, and it's a nice image. It's already stepping back, and we have been doing it here, and we will continue to do it. The witness is partly in a consciousness that is not self, and is partly looking at from a point of view of self. So it's got two sides. And now awareness has that in it. Where I was giving in the guided meditation today, giving some little bit of suggestion about working with awareness as being just pure awareness, not having a self in it. It's just quality of awareness. It's like the air. And yet it's looking at, got a point of view. The witness has a point of view. So it's less selfing, but it's still got some. All of this may seem complicated, but our experience can be really, really simple and clean of selfing in a way that we sometimes don't see. And the reason is that the senses, chushim, the senses, don't always have to have a label on them called I am seeing. The senses are doorways. So they're doorways from consciousness into the world, meaning there's just a gap there. It doesn't have to have a person, me, standing at the doorway. It's a doorway. So seeing is just seeing. Do we need to say, I am seeing something? That's bringing perception and tfisot into the seeing. But the seeing by itself, or the hearing by itself, is just by itself clean of selfing. So we do have that experience all the time. We tend to put a person, the self, in the hearing, the seeing, and there is a Tibetan image that there's a little Buddha. He sits in the eyes, the ears, the nose, the mouth, the touch. This little Buddha sitting there in the senses, telling us, keep clean. No perception needed here. No perception. You don't need constructions. And when we go in the world and just feel, we hear the sound of the leaves, we see, we touch the earth underneath our feet, we can, if it, you know, kind of go into that present moment with very little construction, it has very little selfing there, and it's very clean and liberating. So the senses are our help there. William Blake said, clean the doors of perception, namely senses, clean them from thoughts, concepts, parshanuyot, etc., definitions, havchanot, blah, blah, blah. Just clean them, clean the doors of perception, and everything will seem as it is, namely infinite. And the Buddha said, for some people, contact, which is the point where the senses meet the world, for some people, it's enchanting, captivating. They go into a spell. And so they are washed by the tides of being, drifting along an empty, pointless road, samsara. But others come to understand their activity of the senses, and because they understand it, the stillness fills them with delight. It's from Sutta Nipata. So one of the we're doing this, walking outside, we were doing it. Sitting, breathing, we do it. Listening to the sounds of the birds, we do it. It's meeting the world with less filter. And the me doesn't need to keep jumping up. We can just walk, just touch, just hear, just see, just feel the breathing, just feel the me doesn't really need to jump up. We can begin to kind of sense, yes, there's, it's just not needed. It's an interesting, I've done years of research with researchers in Israel, where I'm the shvafan, how you say? the rabbit experiment, ma? Shafan nisayon. So, you know, I've done all that, been in machines and being tested and being this, being that. And it's been going for years. We've done maybe many, many years, but we have been finding that there's a part of the brain that is activated when the me is needed. But when the me is not needed, it goes to sleep. So it's not really that the me, it's also from the science point of view, it's very hard really to find where is the me in the brain. It's kind of everywhere. But there's a place in the brain that we found. It's also a little, like a little kazer tolat somewhere that is lights up when there's more me and doesn't light up when there's no, when the me is. And they, in all the machines that I was being put in, you know, I was practicing with me being a strong me and a being invisible me, no me. And so this part of the brain light up and went to sleep and light up and went to sleep. It's all dynamic. The me doesn't need to keep jumping up every time we listen to a bird. It just doesn't need to be there. And we more and more can experience it. And when we do that, just like the Buddha said, the stillness fills us with delight. There is something there that cuts through the suffering of the First Noble Truth and the attachment, the second truth. The stillness can feed us with delight. Just listening to the birds, just breathing, just settling into this moment, which has no labels, which has no definitions, which is not controlled by anybody, which is, because their matzig represents something much bigger than us. One of the places, we're going to talk more about this, but one of the places that we can begin to see hitkadmut, the progress in this, is the sense that there's more space in our being and in our life. We will feel more space. If we can feel the opposite, someone that is contracted will all the time feel like someone arguing with you and you immediately having to respond and defend yourself and shout and this and that, very contracted place. If there's more space, someone can say anything. Stephen, you're a total idiot. And there's more space, doesn't go anywhere, doesn't do anything. And you'll feel that in life, less reactive, less challenged, less needy to respond, less needy. So having more space is a practice, is what we practice here. You'll feel more space inside through having less self-dominating our consciousness. The self, the consciousness is more free, more open, and less tied into me, the me. I once asked Stephen Batchelor, who came to Kliel, actually, the first, one of the first retreats in Israel was from Stephen Batchelor. And I asked him how would he describe anatta? And he said, a nice word, he said, transparency. Shakuf, the self is shakuf. You see through it. Anatta is not no self, get rid of it. It's not like that, but it's transparency. You see through it. You don't see it. You don't be controlled by it. You see the self as, and it's really a good way to understand the practice. Now the self is strong, now the self is weak. Where it's strong, if someone comes to you and argues with you, or you feel a threat, and then you, the self jumps up. And if you're in the witness mode, you'll see the self jumping up. Someone challenges you, elbon, gives you an insult, up comes the self, and you'll notice that. And then you're relaxed and, you know, let go at ease and nothing challenging and spaced out and listening to a wonderful Dhamma talk or whatever. And you'll notice, well, there's not much self here. So actually, when you pay attention to selfing, you'll see that it goes up and it goes down and it comes here and it's there. And so that's the key. Don't try and jump to no self. Instead, meet the self, but gradually allow it to be more, see it, in it, that it's dynamic, and you dance with it. You dance with it. And that way, it becomes less of a kind of a gusha thing that's controlling us. It's more like a friend that you dance with. And then you begin to see what is not there, the self. Awareness gets bigger and bigger. The self is a bit like an elephant in the room, pil becheder. So once you see it, you see the elephant. But when you see the elephant, you also see the room, the space, what is beyond the self. But you have to see the elephant in order to see the room. Okay, thank you. Let's take a minute of quiet.